Close.
Thank you. So indeed, I'll be talking about induced mean flows, and some of the conclusions are in the second part of the title, local and non-local induced mean flows. This is joint work with Bruce Sutherland at the University of Alberta, and it was completed when I was a visiting GFD fellow at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, or some part of it was completed there last summer. And I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk here. So the objective of our work was for a vertically and horizontally localized internal gravity wave packet in a uniformly stratified and inviscid ambient to answer two questions. The first one being, is there actually Stokes drift? And what might its spatial structure be? And secondly, is there a return flow? And if so, what might its spatial structure be? And some of the words I use in that, in the way those questions are phrased, come from the way we've started thinking about that problem. So this is an outline of my talk, and I'll start with a bit of a motivation as to how I was originally thinking about this problem, coming from Stokes drift and the return flow for surface gravity wave packets. And that frame of thinking about the problem is the framework I'll try to use today. Then, secondly, I'll just clearly define the problem in the governing equations, and it's the assumptions that we use to tackle this problem. And I'll very briefly, because we're a very mixed audience, I'll review Stokes drift results for X and Z periodic internal gravity waves, namely that there is no Stokes drift for such waves. So it relies on the packet nature of the problem. Then I'll talk about the main results for vertically and horizontally compact internal gravity wave packets. And the main results are derived by a combination of perturbation and separation of scales expansions, plus some slightly more informal scaling laws, and they're all validated using some numerical solutions. And I'll talk about the two types of induced mean flow, a non-local and a local induced flow in turn. So to start with a little bit of motivation, surface gravity wave packets, I think the previous two speakers have already shown us pictures of what Stokes drift means for the surface gravity wave problem, and in particular the picture from Van Dyck's album of fluid motion, where if you look at the trajectories under a periodic, so a nice regular wave, that you see that these orbits, if you're very careful in which one you select on this picture, then they don't quite close, and that small offset, that's the Stokes drift. And that picture is modified quite a bit if you look at, don't look at periodic or regular waves, but if you look at surface gravity wave packets, then there's this counterpart to the Stokes drift, so the Stokes drift being near the free surface, and there's always this return flow, which is sort of is always part of the picture here. You can't think of Stokes drift in a surface gravity wave packet without thinking about the return flow at the same time. And if you integrate up the momentum from deep down up to the surface, then these two effects exactly cancel each other out. And you can also think in some sense of this as an irrotational mass transport. So the Stokes drift takes fluids and transports it to the right, and then the return flow somehow transports it back in a slightly informal sense to its original position. And many people will have seen the sort of the corresponding streamlines of that return flow. And this is sort of the terminology of having this separation of physical domains. So a Stokes drift near the surface and underneath a return flow. You can think of these two effects as two separate things, is how we started to think, and it will turn out to be not very helpful actually, but that's how we started to think about the internal gravity wave problem. So the problem definition and the governing equation. So just a repetition of the problem. So for a vertically and horizontally localized internal wave packet in this uniformly stratified and inviscid, which is important, ambient, to answer these two questions. To do so, we use the following simplifying assumptions. So we work in a Boussinesq setup, no dissipation, as I've stressed. We're interested in weakly nonlinear effects, so there's no feedback of the induced flow on packet propagation. That's beyond the scope of what we do. We're interested in infinite domain. We're not interested in boundary conditions, and it's going to be a two-dimensional setup. and interested in steady states in principle, not in initial transients, although in some of the numerical results we'll be looking at, so the initial transients play a role. And our original hypothesis of how this problem might work is if you have this compact internal gravity wave packet, and in some sense you have a Stokes drift associated with that, might there also be a return flow around it? And this will turn out to be a somewhat naive picture. With the terminology I'll use when I use the word resultant flow or wave-induced mean flow, I'll talk about the sum of both this Stokes drift and this return flow.
So rather than terminology, could you just say what you mean by Stokes drift precisely?
Yes, I'm going to do that. Yeah, you're quite right. That's going to come. Right. So first, the governing... they're going to be two, a local effect and a sort of a non-local effect. We'll talk about that much detail later. So the standard governing equations in a two-dimensional setup, x and z, with a linear stratification characterized by a buoyancy frequency n, and the equations, the x and z momentum equation and a incompressibility condition and an energy an internal energy conservation statement. And then these are rewritten in terms of, rather than thinking in terms of a density perturbation delta rho, everything's rewritten in a corresponding vertical displacement psi, so we get the equation system on the right. These can be combined to eliminate pressure into one system, which one equation, which we'll focus on mainly, which helps us, which describes these internal gravity waves, which is a linear operator operating on a stream function L over there, driven in some sense by some nonlinear terms on the right. So it's a divergence of this nonlinear term, and the nonlinear term is always a product of these two sort of these two terms, a horizontal velocity vector, zeta here being the vorticity and psi being this vertical perturbation. There's always a second equation in the background linking the psi to the psi. So as a slight review for X and Z periodic internal gravity waves, so no packet structure, just standard internal gravity waves, the standard linear solutions to the problem. So if you turn off the right-hand side, because that's nonlinear, and then you find its linear solutions over there, you get the standard relationships, which we will all have seen with, I use theta to denote the angle here of the wave number vector. And it turns out that these linear solutions actually solve the nonlinear equations exactly. So there's no nonlinearity. That also means, in some sense, if we think about Stokes drift in a sort of a Lagrangian sense, if we track the position of our particles and we do a potato series expansion, and we allow for the particle to move from its original position, and we track that, then there is no Stokes drift resulting from that. So the actual individual particle trajectories unlike these little loops which didn't quite close, they're these straight lines, and there's no Stokes drift here. On to main results for horizontally and vertically compact internal gravity wave groups. I'll be looking at a Gaussian packet, and I'll be making the simplifying assumption that its characteristic width in the x and the z direction is equivalent, although the results are more general than that. The results are also more general than a Gaussian packet, but that's what I'll be using. And in particular, for some of the videos I'll be showing you, I'll be looking at a configuration where the phase velocity and the group velocity are positive in the positive x direction. And the method is, as I said, it's a bivariate separation of scale slash perturbation expansion in two small parameters. So this problem is really a problem of two small parameters. There's a steepness parameter, alpha, the standard small parameter, and there's a bandwidth parameter, epsilon. So we need to track both. The numerical method we use solves the time arches, the evolution equations for zeta and psi, and includes some viscous damping for numerical stability, and it has horizontally periodic and free slip boundary conditions at the lower and the upper boundary, so free slip and horizontally periodic And it's discretized using Fourier modes in X and an evenly spaced grid in the vertical. A little bit of notation in the next few slides. I'll be using superscripts to denote the order in alpha and subscripts to denote the order in epsilon, small parameter. So I'll talk about these two wave-induced effects, and I'll start by talking about what we'll refer to as the non-local response. So here is sort of what I'll try to describe is what I'd like to understand as the Stokes drift effect, which is an effect that's understood in the literature, certainly for internal gravity wave groups, which are periodic in the x direction but confined in the z direction. And this is half of the momentum equations. If we look at half of that, we see that the advective terms there, they give rise in some sense to a forcing, which gives rise to a mean flow. If we then work with a slow scale, two slow scales, x and z, each moving with the group velocity components, then we can we can eliminate the temporal operators, and this sort of half, I should stress, this is clearly half of the picture. But this gives rise to an induced mean flow, which I'll call it a Stokes drift, this USD. And you can see here it's a quantity that's alpha squared and a zeroth order in epsilon, and it actually points in the direction of the group velocity. Yes. Yeah. This is clearly Eulerian. This is a Eulerian effect. That's right. And it will become. So this, in some sense, it's the mean flow component that might arise from just considering just the momentum flux divergence terms, and it's not a Lagrangian effect. You're right. And if we look at that picture of that flow field, just that flow field, which is half the picture. On the left, you see that it points in the direction of the group velocity, and it actually transports mass if you look at it, which is clearly why this can't be the entire picture. So what we need a second flow to make up the total flow field at second order. We need to add on what we'd like to think of as a return flow in some sense. So a second component, because we've thrown away a lot of the terms in the momentum equations. We've only looked at part there. And if we look at go back to the overall equation and take stock about what sort of orders we have there, and we see the right-hand side is the forcing term, driving resultant flows. If we take stock, the first time the right hand side is going to drive a mean flow, the first time there's going to be a non-zero term. It's clearly going to be squared in alpha, but it's going to be third order in epsilon. And two of those orders arise because of the operators in front of the product, in front of the linear terms there, and either of the linear terms will have to be slow. So if we then look at the same order as this previous sort of semi-confusing Stokes drift occurred, if we look at that same order, then it actually turns out this equation here is the governing equation for the entire flow field at that order. And if we combine that with the same order, the fact that we have to have incompressibility, then we can solve these two equations, and we get the result that u can only be a function if we eliminate any indefinite growth in the x direction, that the horizontal velocity can only be a function of z and not of x. And in fact, I'll make this much clearer by showing some videos of the numerics in a second. But what this total induced mean flow requires, it requires that there's no net flow in the vertical direction. So in some sense, looking at that previously, that confusing picture where we saw this Eulerian Stokes drift pointing in both the x and the z direction, its z component has to be completely and locally cancelled out by what we might refer to as the Stokes drift. So the sum is such that there's zero. So there's all vertical motion is actually inhibited. And then if we look at the horizontal component, we have the result that the total horizontal velocity can't actually be a function of x at that order. So what this what happens here, that the wave group induces these horizontally long disturbances. And these horizontally long disturbances, which the total amount of momentum you can, by integrating up over the, what we'll talk about in a second, by smoothing out the Stokes drift over the whole domain. I'll talk about why that can be the domain length in a second. But just to so we have this idea of no motion at all in the vertical direction and these long disturbances which we predict in the x direction. And what I'm going to show you now are some numerical results at a moderately, quite a low sort of nonlinearity, and this is the bandwidth parameter, 1 over 20 here. What I'm going to show is the horizontal velocity on the left-hand side is going to be just the total signal. On the right-hand side, I'm going to filter out the linear signal. So anything here is going to be it's going to be not part of the original linear signal. And what was a Fourier filtering of VIA. And what you see happen is that almost instantaneously, and I'll talk about what almost instantaneously means in a second, in front of the packet, as the packet moves down, it induces indeed what seems to be these long disturbances. So there doesn't seem to be any or much variation of this magnitude of the, so the pictures haven't come out very well, the scaled horizontal velocity. There are these long disturbances. And the fact that there's a blue disturbance here is to do with the initial transients, as we haven't imposed the right initial conditions because we've imposed initial conditions in which there's no induced mean flow at all. And I'll talk about these initial conditions a bit more later. But we do get this idea of these long disturbances. So if we then think a little bit about if these disturbances are long, how long, in fact, are they? Because if they're infinitely long, or in fact, if they're the length of the domain, then if we set the length of the domain to infinity, then it clearly goes to zero. We have a finite amount of momentum available. We can't have a non-zero induced mean flow we can't have that on an infinite domain. So we have to think more physically about what this length scale might be. And the length scale we get a length scale provided by thinking about these disturbances as horizontally long waves. And they have associated with them a group speed, and they're induced at any point in the vertical. These horizontal long waves are induced on the time scale related to the time scale of the vertical transit of the packet. So it's sigma z, just sigma divided by its vertical group velocity. Combining these two gives us some idea that shouldn't be inequality. That's just a sort of, it's just a scaling result. It gives us the extent or some scaling result for the extent of this horizontally long excitation. And that extent is much greater than sigma, the characteristic width of the packet itself. And that gives rise to this idea of these responses being non-local. So if we then look at the sort of total budget of induced mean flow momentum, and we integrate that up, and we use this result that this characteristic length scale is much greater than sigma, we get a nice expression for this with total amount, which is only a function of z and time and not a function of x. And we can also find by dividing by this characteristic length scale, we can get an expression for the induced mean flow of these long disturbances, which now scales as alpha squared epsilon. So because of the smoothing out over this length scale, we get a one order higher in epsilon. And I'll show now the what I was showing you previously is it was a zoomed in version of the total numerics. Our numerical domain has to be much greater than this new length scale because it has to capture it all. And what this is going to show is the same picture as before, evolving in time. And on the right hand side, I'm going to show you the theoretical curve on the previous page, the dashed line of this total amount of momentum here. And now you should we still have epsilon being 1 over 20, so this is quite a large domain. And what we see then is that these what seem to be horizontal disturbances, this is still the horizontal velocity being plotted, they're actually inclined. So And you can see that originally, if you look on the left-hand side, originally the curve, originally the measured from the numerics, the black curve, which is calculated from the numerics, and the theoretical curve were not in the same place because we didn't impose the right boundary conditions. If we time march for long enough, it will turn out that our expressions match quite nicely what we calculate from the numerics here, with some small differences being due to some nonlinearity and some dispersion. Right, so that's that, and then we get this in some sense the horizontal extent actually scales quite nicely on this length scale we develop, and we've checked how that characteristic scale scales, and it scales the same way in the numerics as epsilon to the minus 2. We also get an angle here, kappa, which denotes this because our source of excitation travels with a group velocity. We can divide that by the associated group speed of long disturbances, and we see that the angle then comes out as epsilon. So the angle actually turns out to scale with this bandwidth parameter, epsilon. So now on to so that's the non-local response. Then the second response is a local response. And the local response trivially arises if you time march the linear equations, you particle track the linear equations, but you allow for an envelope. And I'm first going to naively just time march this and see what happens. So I allow for a Gaussian envelope, and I simply time march those equations. And in the gravity wave problem, that would give rise to these loops that didn't quite close. What happens here is if you look at the position of an individual particle prior to the arrival of the packet and after the packet's it's gone past, it undergoes the individual wiggles of the waves that make up the packet, but there is in fact a small displacement. And if we look at that small displacement in XZ space, we see that small displacement is in a direction, and I'll illustrate that better in the next picture, it's in a direction opposite to the group velocity. So if we, in the old coordinate system here, the group velocity was pointing in this direction, we're finding a small displacement in this opposite direction. Now if we transform coordinate systems, so Z star is in that direction and X star is in the direction orthogonal to it, we can confirm, not numerically, but just from the expressions, from the expansions, that there is no net Lagrangian. Now this is a Lagrangian mean, you should probably have a little bar on top actually, but this is now a Lagrangian mean velocity. That's zero in the direction orthogonal to the group velocity, and there is actually a non-zero displacement in the direction of opposite to the group velocity. That arises because of both slow temporal modulation of the envelope and spatial variation of the envelope. And that those Lagrangian mean velocities, they now scale as alpha squared and epsilon squared too. So they're one order higher in the small parameter epsilon than the non-local effect. So as you see here, this is just a picture of this Lagrangian mean flow field, and it's in the direction opposite to the group velocity vector. We can integrate that Lagrangian mean velocity field to give a total displacement over here, and that total displacement, if we plot that total displacement, so Lagrangian displacement of particles of one after the groups move past, we plot the delta x, the displacement in the x direction and the displacement in the z direction, you see that along the trajectory of the packet, the whole fluid column is moved in the direction opposite to the group velocity. So I think our delta x is negative and delta z is positive. If we then return to our numerical results, and we also do a Lagrangian tracking on the numerical results, now I'm plotting the color scale now denotes the wave packet filtered. So again, we filter the linear signal. We plot the horizontal displacement on the left and the vertical displacement on the right. We're going to see a similar picture. So as the packet travels down, it indeed creates these long columns of displaced fluid. So this is the net displacement here, which ties up nicely and scales in the same way as our results. Did you say 5 minutes? Was that 10 minutes? Well, I'll do just that. Right, so to sum up, two wave-induced effects, what we call a non-local response, which is a sort of a Eulerian-type phenomenon, which scales as alpha squared and first or it's first order and epsilon. All vertical motion by this non-local response is suppressed. The resultant is only in the horizontal direction, and the resultant consists of these horizontally long responses, which we can think of as long waves. They're not confined to the group, hence non-local. And then there is a second effect, and that's this local response, and that's actually a more traditional Lagrangian type effect, and that's smaller. It's one order higher in epsilon, the smaller the bandwidth parameter. And the non-zero velocities are confined to the wave group, and hence the term local. And this we don't think is balanced by return flow in any way, because in a Boutonesque model, these particles which are transported against the stratification, they don't have associated with them a density under the Boutonesque approximation. Hence, there is a possibility for particles to be moved against the stratification, as we saw on these previous plots. Particles are actually moved against the stratification, which would be non-energy conserving, but I think due to the Boutonesque approximation, that is admissible here. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Just a very brief one. Nothing depend on y in your formulation?
Y being?
The
So
it was x, z, was there a y dependence?
No, completely two-dimensional.
I see.
So in fact, it's not there.
So if you had a packet that was confined in x, y, x, z, and y, would you expect a different?
Yeah, I think so, because then
kind of a circulation in the.
I think that's quite different. There is another degree of freedom which is not inhibited by stratification, so I think this would be quite different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions? You want to hear?
I didn't understand your argument why it's possible to have a vertical displacement that lasts. I mean, the buoyancy will be conserved on the particle, right, in the Boutonesque system, so the particle has to come down again.
Yeah, so and in principle, the particle has to come down. But in the numerics also, the particle doesn't come down. And I think that just first seemed puzzling. That clearly can't be, right? The particle has to come down.
Yep.
But I think under the Boutonesque approximation, because I suspect that the particles, they don't have associated. It's that when you make the Boutonesque approximation, is that perturbation to that you throw out. So in some sense, it doesn't. From that perspective, it doesn't have to come down.
Well,
in a real world, it would.
In the Boutonesque system, there is a materially invariant buoyancy variable, the stratification,
yeah.
E plus N squared Z, or anything equivalent, that marks the stratification that goes up and down with
yeah.
the displacement. So it is that field, however it's related to the density, that would be get an undulation, get a hump under this process, and that would create vorticity and would create a gravity wave. So
but would you say if, I mean, would you, at the end of this simulation, where we actually find that at the end these particles have moved up in the vertical direction, this red displacement here, there is, would that, you would expect that to flow back?
I would that expect to certainly not stay there. No, I don't think it's the symmetry of the system that you can rearrange particles in this way, and that's just another steady state.
Is it possible that the numeric has an intrinsic thermal diffusivity
It does have a thermal diffusivity, that's
but
right.
Not.
It does.
Yes, well that probably something to do with it, isn't it? You need to look at the mean
so,
equation, the buoyancy.
No, that's right. And we have also been looking, in some sense, inspired by the Longwood, Higgins and Stewart, this sort of return flow, looking at whether there might be another flow, theoretically also, that transports this back. And there doesn't seem to be such a thing. Normally, you might expect in the same way as the surface gravity wave problem, so these particles are being transported by this Stokes drift, so then something would bring it back. And there is no such flow in an analogy to Longwood, Higgins and Stewart type of return flow, which brings these things back, that simply doesn't exist. So I might be completely wrong, and it might be the numeric, as you say, pointed out, the numerics putting me on the wrong track, but I suspect it is because under the Boutonesque approximations, these particles being moved it's that density term that you've thrown out. But I'm
you have to say that you
describe it, you just need to look at the model buoyancy field to see if it's got that pattern or not. If it had that pattern, it couldn't be a thermal state. And probably you find the particles have moved up, but the buoyancy field hasn't changed after.
I would need to check that. That's a good point. Okay.
Well, you're going to get a sense of the buoyancy field. It has to be the same as it was in the beginning.
Yeah.
You can look at the census of the buoyancy. Yeah. So you have to have the same distribution of buoyancy at the end and in the beginning.
Yeah.
And the numerics will fail and subtly in that.
Well, so our understanding is, well, we'll check.
So one more comment. I mean, my knowledge, the first time that this was, this kind of problem was studied was by Bretherton in 1969, I think.
Yeah,
suggested that paper. Yeah. To what extent does this agree with his conclusions?
So my understanding of the Bretherton work, and that might be completely flawed, is that in there, the Bretherton flow, that relies on, and you could probably point out, if that relies on viscous, there is viscosity in there always that allows, but I might be completely wrong. I'm completely wrong. Excellent. Well, I'll talk about it later, hopefully.
Well, have you looked at the paper?
I have looked at the paper, yes.
Your work does agree with Bretherton in one respect, which is the two dimensional long waves.
That's right. Okay.
Are there other questions and comments? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.